Hello, my bubblas. It's nice to be back with all of you. Happy New Year. I hope you had a meaningful fast and a good ceiling. I wrote in the Substack this week, I did a piece about Yom Kippur, and I wrote that I find Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to be so precious to me. I didn't always feel that way. I used to dread them. I used to see them as just interminably long and boring and stuck in synagogue. I've come to treasure them as a high point in a time of year that I otherwise don't like. I hate September. It's the month when I think everything bad in my life seemed to happen in September. And so I've just dreaded it every year. And I know we're through it. It's October now, but like this wasn't a good September for me either. And maybe it's coincidence. Maybe it's a lot of coincidence, but it's, you know, I dread September. And I know that the months of winter and cold and darkness lie ahead. And I get it. Life is cyclical. The seasons are cyclical. Like I understand that, right? That a classical mistake that I have made and others I know have made is to take the current moment and how you feel in that moment and extrapolate it out forever. And I've learned that that's not the right thing to do. When things are good, they won't always be good. And when things are bad, they won't always be bad. But there are some other joyous Jewish holidays ahead to cheer us up. We've got Sukkot starting on Sunday night. Simchas Torah starts in 10 days. I'm helping someone in my apartment building to build a sukkah this afternoon. I'm looking forward to doing that. We set it up in the courtyard of the building, and anyone who wants to can eat their meals in the sukkah. I'm not going to sleep in it. That seems a little extreme. But also, the Yankees are in the playoffs. The Giants are having a good start to the season, believe it or not. There are places to find hope. And hope is something we love. So remember how earlier this year Elon Musk signed a deal to buy Twitter? And it was amazing. So he bought a lot of shares in Twitter, like 9% of the company. And then he said he wanted to be on the board. Then he said he didn't want to be on the board. Then he said he was buying the whole company. And then he said he didn't want to buy the whole company and that they had tricked him somehow. And his legal footing for saying they had tricked him was never strong. So it was pretty clear he was always going to lose that fight, and it turned into a lawsuit. And as they reached the precipice of him being deposed this past week, he relented and he said, okay, forget the lawsuit. We'll just close the deal as I promised to do. And, you know, it's interesting to trace over time, because when he started this, if you remember, the Twitter employees were like, no, keep him away. He's bad news. He's going to ruin this. We don't want him involved with Twitter. He's too based. He's too right wing. And they were all like too left wing and they had to keep him away. And then it was like, no, we should force him to buy Twitter. And it was amazing how instantaneously the sentiment on whether he should have to buy Twitter changed. And I mean, Twitter, I like using it. It feels kind of like it's still broken. It is stagnant. It hasn't changed much for many years. I don't think anyone uses any of the new features that they have created. I don't think they've gotten a lot of uptake. So innovation has clearly stalled there. They still have the problem of censorship. And that raises an interesting question. Like, you know, in general, I am very much pro free speech. Very few people will tell you that anymore. And so I will err on the side of free speech. That said, a Twitter in which you can't censor anything, and I'm not sure that's the perfect word, but a Twitter where you can't censor anything it could end up being just junk, right? It's filled with total dreck. So maybe there's a solution where you say, like, here are the spam filters, and by default, they're turned on for everyone, but you can turn them off. And so Twitter is not actually preventing the spam from posting, but rather catching it in a filter that you as the user can turn on and off. But what do you do with the Donald Trumps? I am a believer that Donald Trump should never have been kicked off of Twitter. I'm a believer that Twitter has censored political speech. That's not spam, that's political speech. And they've done it to favor one side instead of another. That's why they banned the Babylon Bee. That's why they banned the New York Post from talking about Hunter Biden. It's not just because all of the bad speech is coming from one side politically. It's because there is a bias there. And so the question is, do they have the right to censor? If they were a newspaper, let's imagine it was the New York Times. They can print whatever they want. If they want to print stuff that's liberal, they can do it. If they want to say stuff that's conservative, they can do it. They can say whatever they want. But if they write something that is untrue, they're on the hook for it. That's libel. So they have to make sure that what they say, they can support. Now, by contrast, if you think about, say, the phone company, if I call someone up on the phone and I say something that is libelous, AT&T is not on the hook for that. AT&T can't be sued because I say something that is libelous on the phone. The New York Times could be sued if they run an editorial that says something libelous, or if I, as an author, write something libelous in the newspaper. And so the question is, where should Twitter fall? If Twitter is the former, if it's a media publication, let them censor whoever they want, Donald Trump or Elon Musk or anyone. But then they're on the hook. And if they don't want to be on the hook, then they should not be allowed to censor political speech. So it seems now that Elon Musk is going to close the deal. It seems that it's going to close in the next few weeks. I mean, I think the banks that agreed to lend money to finance this deal are going to be totally fucked. They're going to lose a ton. There's $13 billion of debt financing. I can't imagine that debt is worth more than 80 cents on the dollar right now, maybe even less. I mean, there's a scenario you could imagine where Elon buys in the debt at 80 cents on day one or whatever the price is and just reduces Twitter's debt load out of the gate. But I don't know that he would want to put more equity into this. You know, the rumor is, and I don't know where this comes from, but the rumor is that Elon Musk wants to build something called like Application X, and that it would be like the American version of WeChat, right? WeChat is this Chinese everything app. So you open, you know, in the US, like you open your phone and then you see all of your apps laid out on the home screen. In China, you open your phone and then you open WeChat. And all of your apps are within WeChat. You want to order a ride? You do it within WeChat. You want to order food for delivery? You do it in WeChat. You want to post something to a social network? You do it in WeChat. So WeChat has lots of apps within it. Now, this is good for the Chinese government because it gives the Chinese censors one single choke point. It allows them to cut off a user in one spot. It allows them to control people in one spot. I'm not sure that there is a market for something like that in the US. Like you could make the case why that might be convenient, but I'm not sure people are really demanding that. Certainly not with the censorship piece of it. And speaking of Chinese apps, you know, what happened to the idea of banning TikTok? Like I've seen so many people whose brains just turn to liquid because of TikTok. And I think Trump had a pretty good point when he said we should ban TikTok. TikTok is a Chinese Trojan horse. Whether because the Chinese are trying to make us retarded by you know, creating this app that turns everyone's brain to mush, or because the Chinese want to have an app that they can control the content that people in America are being fed, I see TikTok as a propaganda tool of the Chinese government. So I continue to believe that TikTok is dangerous to America. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Twitter. We'll cover it more. I think he has until October 28th to close the deal. So, you know, TBD. One of the things I wrote about this week in the Substack that I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about this here is these cheating scandals in chess and poker and fishing that have popped up over the past month. Now, I'm not a games person. I don't give a shit about chess or poker. Definitely don't fish. Like I don't. I find it all to be pretty boring. I've been to casinos in different places, and I get so bored. As soon as I set foot inside, I'm like, ugh, this is gross. I can't wait to leave. When I've been in poker tournaments, I like after 10 minutes, I'm like, I'm all in. I can't wait until I lose so I can go home. And I don't. You know, it always surprised me a little bit that I'm not a card player because I'm an addict. And I was hooked on sports betting for a few months. That was like 15 or 18 years ago or something, which that's not good sober behavior. And especially because I bet the same way that I used to drink, which is just no thought of tomorrow. It's all in the present moment and it was a disaster. But, I haven't done that in a very long time. But it's interesting to see these scandals and to think about why they're occurring. So in chess, the greatest player in the world right now is this guy, Magnus Carlsen. He's maybe the greatest player who ever lived. He's also just like a handsome guy. He's 31 years old. He's very charismatic. He does all kinds of cool stuff. And he played in a tournament last month against this guy named Hans Niemann. Niemann is 19 years old. He's relatively unknown and has a history of cheating in online chess. And in that tournament, Hans Niemann beat Magnus Carlsen. I mean, that's like if I beat Michael Jordan in one-on-one basketball. It's so unlikely that you would have to conclude that I cheated, that I had rockets in my shoes. And not only that, Magnus Carlsen said that when they played, Hans Niemann didn't even seem to be paying attention. He didn't even seem to be focused. And then they got paired up in another tournament last week, and Magnus withdrew from the tournament and refused to play against Hans Niemann. Chess.com is the biggest chess website. And Chess.com put out a 100-page report showing mathematical evidence that Hans Niemann had cheated. It's not proof, but they produced evidence that showed that his moves were 100% correlated with the most advanced chess computers. Even Magnus Carlsen is not usually more than 70 or 72% correlated. So for him to be 100% correlated with the perfect move in multiple games is so unlikely that it shows he must have cheated. Now the question is, how did he do it? And what I love about this is that it seems the leading theory is that Hans Niemann had vibrating anal beads, that he put some sort of a thing in his ass that vibrated in Morse code, connected to a transmitter that would tell him the perfect move based on what was happening. That's fucking crazy. And I don't know that he did it, but there's a lot of speculation that that was how he did it. And then last week, there was another scandal in poker where there's a game between this woman named Robbie Liu, and she's playing against a guy named Garrett Edelstein, and the betting action made no sense. And her body language is weird, and it's clear she's nervous and shifty, and something weird is going on. And she won $269,000 in the game. And afterwards, when he confronted her, he was stunned. And when he confronted her, she's like, ah, yeah, she made up some crazy explanation and gave him the money back. That's a lot of money to give back if you just won that fair and square. And so there's a question. Maybe she had the same anal beads that Hans Niemann had. Maybe she had some sort of a vibrating ring. There's a video I posted on Substack where you can see her fucking around with her ring for a while. So maybe that is what happened. And then in fishing, in competitive fishing, there were these two guys who were stuffing lead weights into the fish that they caught. Because I guess the winner is whoever catches the most pounds of fish in a certain amount of time or something. And they were stuffing lead weights and fish fillets from other fish into the mouths of the fish that they had caught to make them appear to be heavier. Now, these guys actually got caught in the act, right? Like the how is very clear. But I'm not sure that stuffing lead weights in the fish is any crazier than the vibrating anal beads. Or less crazy. Like I mean, people will go to significant lengths to cheat at stuff. It's unfortunate. And I don't have like a great theory about why, other than people just, you know, they don't want to put in the effort. They want the easy win and they don't want to put in the effort. But it's pretty fucking wild that this has been going on so much over the past month or 2 months, and maybe it's been going on forever. I don't know, but it's pretty incredible to see. One of the topics that is controversial, and I've written about it a bit, is the idea of ESG investing. ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. And the idea was originally that if you are an investor, you can force change in public policy. Because if you refuse to invest in companies that aren't doing ESG-friendly stuff, then those companies, their stock price will go down, their cost of capital will go up, and it will make it more expensive for them to do things. So, like, what are ESG-friendly things? Well, you know, the simple examples were like, don't invest in companies that are making coal mining or fossil fuels or gun companies. What is the G for governance? I don't know. Maybe that's like companies that have too much ownership concentration or bad governance principles. But the problem is that's very malleable. And it's really in the eye of whoever is investing. What are good social principles? If you were an ESG money manager and you said, my social principles are, I'm not going to invest in companies that support gay marriage, like that may be socially what you believe, but others might find that appalling. So there's no common standard of what is good policy here, and what does the S in this mean? What does the G stand for? What does it represent conceptually? What about like weapons companies, Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or Northrop Grumman? You know, I think ESG investors have traditionally said we are not going to invest in these weapons companies, but then what happens when suddenly the conflict in Ukraine is considered ESG friendly and Lockheed Martin is shipping weapons, Raytheon is shipping missiles? Do those companies suddenly become ESG friendly? It just feels very, vague. It feels like it's too loosey-goosey. And one of the biggest ESG investors is BlackRock. Now, you know, BlackRock, to understand BlackRock, let's take a quick step back. And this is something that we've talked about a little bit before, but historically, if you made a bunch of money, you would go to the brokerage firm that had an office on Main Street in your town, and you'd give them your money, and then they'd go and buy some stocks for you, right? They'd go buy, let's buy 100 shares of this stock and 100 shares of this stock, and they would tell you what to buy, and they'd do it. And then they'd get a little commission every time they bought or sold a stock. The problem was, those folks were always underperforming compared to the broader stock market. So the market goes up 10%. Maybe you're lucky if that guy was up 8%. And then it's like, what am I paying him for? Why can't I just be up as much as the market? And if the market goes down, why can't I be down as much as the market? What is the market? It's the S&P 500. That's all people look at. And so it was really hard to find a way to mirror for a very long time. It was hard to find a way for an ordinary investor to mirror the performance of the S&P 500. And along came ETFs, that's exchange traded funds. And BlackRock is the largest creator of exchange traded funds. What they have done is create a vehicle that lets you buy and sell the entire market at once, something that will track the market to the penny and give you exposure to it without having to pick individual stocks. The market goes up 10%, you'll be up 10%. All you need to do is buy the ETF. Easy to buy, easy to sell. Fees are inconsequentially small. And BlackRock was the real innovator in this ETF space. And then they created other ETFs to mimic other things that were hard for people to buy and sell. You want exposure to the price of oil? They can create an ETF that allows you to have exposure to that. So if you're BlackRock, you effectively own, because you are exposed to the entire market, that means you own shares in every company in the stock market, which means, let's pick a sector, say airlines. If you own every airline, you don't really care whether Delta is the winner or United is the winner or American is the winner. You care about all of them being winners. And that creates an incentive when you have this cross-ownership, that creates an incentive to act almost like a cartel, almost like a monopoly, because you now control the entire industry in a sense. And so you don't want to see Delta win, but United and American lose. You want to see them all win. What does that mean? You want to see pricing discipline. You want to see margin discipline. You don't want to see a price war ever. And you, as the investor who owns all of these, the influential investor who owns all of these, you can be the go-between to help facilitate that sort of cartel, that sort of collusion within an industry. That's what you're worried about, is the success of all industries. You can almost think of BlackRock as a cartel. But still, ETFs are a much better approach for, like, almost every single person than picking individual stocks. And when you go and give your money to the broker down the street, you better make sure he's not picking individual stocks. He's not going to do a good job. He is always the last one to know. But you know, ESG, which BlackRock has really pioneered, ESG sort of gets this bad rap because it feels so malleable. But if you are BlackRock, and you own every company in the world, I could make an argument that instead of calling it ESG, just refer to risk factors. And your risk factors are huge worldwide things. If you're BlackRock You don't really care whether ExxonMobil is the winner or British Petroleum or Royal Dutch or whatever. You don't care about that. What you care about is that they're all winners. You don't care if Delta wins versus United. You care that they all win. But they all lose if there are certain worldwide risk factors. Say a nuclear war or environmental devastation. That's what BlackRock has to be afraid of. And so if you're BlackRock, you could make an argument that the right way to invest is to pay attention to those global risk factors. And if you think of ESG as another way of saying global risk factors, and I know they're not the exact same thing, but that's a very rational way for an investor that is a cartel, an investor that owns everything. That is a rational idea and a rational way for them to look at the world. So ESG gets a bad rap. And I think ESG, the in the sort of loosey-goosey sense, the way it used to be considered, deserved that bad rap. But I do think there is something credible to the idea. One of the very first things I ever talked about on this show was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. The pipeline runs between Russia and Germany, and it delivers natural gas from Russia to Germany. Now, as regular listeners of the show will know, Germany had tons of nuclear power. Russia had lots of natural gas they wanted to sell, and Russia undermined Germany's nuclear power industry so that Germany would start buying gas from Russia. How did they do that? Well, first of all, they bribed the former chancellor, that's like the president of Germany, Gerhard Schroeder. As soon as he stepped down, he became a paid servant of Vladimir Putin. It's crazy to me that in the U.S. there was this obsession with, is Donald Trump on the payroll of the Russian government? And meanwhile, Germany's president or ex-president literally was, as were numerous other politicians in Germany. I mean, they still are. And once Germany shut down all of their nuclear power plants, which they did only because of protesters who were paid by the Russian government, once they shut down those power plants, then they become completely dependent on Russian gas. Now, Russia jumped the gun a little bit. They launched the war in Ukraine before Germany was already buying gas through the second pipeline, Nord Stream 2. But Germany had already shut down their nuclear plants. And so now you have this massive war in Ukraine perpetrated by Putin and the Russians, and he is a bad dude. And you have this massive war in Ukraine, and Germany is helpless to do much about it. Why? Because they're dependent on Russia. But they are trying. They're trying. Give them some credit. They're trying to stop the Russians in little minor ways. And so what did Vladimir Putin do? He sabotaged the Nord Stream pipeline. It's leaking now. It's not delivering gas. So what does that mean? It means that as we are entering the winter, Germany doesn't have nuclear power, and they're not getting natural gas from Russia. If it's a cold winter, it is going to be brutal in Germany. And this war in Ukraine is going to turn into, it already is turning into, a war between Russia and Germany over natural gas. And who wins that war will depend on whether this is a very bad winter. It is crazy to me that Germany shut down its nuclear power. It is crazy to me that Germany outsourced its energy policy, and really, the by extension, the energy policy for most of Europe, to an autistic girl who didn't finish high school. Like, why on earth did anyone listen to Greta Thunberg? Why did people think that was a good idea to let her make policy? And now that it's clear her policies were devastating and stupid, she has just sort of disappeared from the public eye. But that's really what's happening now. This war was enabled by Greta Thunberg. Was that a good idea? Now, I don't think we are on the cusp of nuclear war over Ukraine. I'm not saying it's good, but I don't think we're on the cusp of nuclear war as some commentators are frothing at the mouth to tell you. You know, there was an interesting piece that Tyler Cowen published. It was an email from someone named Trey Howard about this. I thought it was really interesting. He lists 9 points spelling out why he thinks that a nuclear war is unlikely right now. And I'll try to paraphrase those slightly and summarize them a bit. Number one, Ukrainian military power is overrated. So his point is Ukraine just doesn't have enough power to truly destroy Russia and push Russia back. And so that means it's a slower war, which gives time for Putin to adjust his plans. Okay, makes some sense. Number two, Russian military power is underrated. The dominant narrative is that Russia's shambolic mobilization will fail. It's still too early to tell. It's an interesting point. It's possible that many of the reservists are truck drivers and stevedores that will actually help Russia's supply chain issues. I mean, the idea here is that Russia has just rounded up like 300,000 men, able-bodied men, and said, now you're soldiers, and shipped them off to the front line. What this email is saying is that Putin assumed a huge political risk to do that, which means that he thinks that the war can still be won conventionally. Number three, no one is crossing red lines. Putin has said what his red lines are. Biden has said what his red lines are. No one's crossing those yet. And so that means nuclear war is unlikely. Number four, Russia has not used chemical weapons. They've had ample opportunities to use them, but they haven't used those, and that would be a step towards escalating to nuclear. Number five, Russia has more non-nuclear options, things like sabotaging the Nord Stream pipeline that we just talked about. There are other things they can do before nuclear war. Number six, Russia believes it will win the energy war. We just covered that. Number seven, international political trends still favor Russia. And I guess by that, what he means is that there are more right-wing folks being elected in Italy, we talked about, in Sweden. We've covered these in the past couple of weeks. And, you know, let's see what happens in the U.S. congressional election. And the implication is that right-wing folks are more allied with Putin. I'm not sure I truly believe that. I do think they are more skeptical of the pro-Ukraine consensus, though. Number eight, Putin's reign at home remains secure. I guess I don't really have a great sense of that. I mean, no one has emerged to rival him, it seems. So I guess it seems secure, but I don't really have a great sense of that. And number nine, Russian nuclear threats are rational. So we should continue to see warnings not to intervene directly as warnings rather than foreshadowing imminent use. I mean, I guess all those points added up make sense. I don't think either of them gives certainty that we're not on the cusp of nuclear war, but it is a compelling way to make the argument that we are not on the cusp of nuclear war. And I hope we're not. You know, it's interesting to me that when you think of any major conflict, like picture a conflict in Africa that you've seen pictures of from the past 30 or 40 years. And the first image that always comes to my mind is of soldiers riding around in what's called a technical. A technical is a white Toyota pickup truck, usually with a machine gun in the back, you know, in the bed of the truck. And you can, like, now that I'm saying it, you can totally envision that. How come those haven't become part of the landscape in Ukraine? Because I feel like those were a part of every other conflict. Maybe they'll show up. I don't know. Maybe that's what Raytheon is exporting to Ukraine right now. That's all for now. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Nice to be here with all of you. You can always find more on Substack, leebressler.substack.com. Sign up to become a paid supporter. And we'll be back with more soon.